got this from a historical point. Where would we be on the spectrum of society of such completely safe as related to public society?
This is an excellent question, one which I pondered, and one which I don't know quite how to answer. I would say this, that we have aborted more babies in the last 13 years than have been aborted in any known civilized country since the beginning of history. Now, Rome was famous for its abortions, but the population of the Roman Empire was much smaller, and the methods of abortion were not what they are today. You couldn't go down to a clinic and get it done, and the state didn't pay for it. So I don't know the number in Roman society, but I do know that we are guilty of that to a far greater degree. Now, Rome tolerated lesbianism. As a matter of fact, Catullus, a Roman poet of the Silver Age, the second century, wrote a poem to his lesbian mate, or to a known lesbian, which has come down in Roman literature as illustrative of the Silver Age. I have it in a textbook at home. homosexuality was rampant in the Roman Empire. Again, there's no Gallup poll to determine the number. I should say this, that homosexuality and lesbianism and abortions were more prevalent, much more prevalent in Roman Italy and in modern, in what we call France, than they were elsewhere. You see, wherever the Roman people had gone, they took their vices with them. On the contrary, one of the problems of the Roman Empire is this, that the Visigoths and the Franks and the Ostrogoths and the Anglo-Saxons were hardy groups, and while they did practice violence, and while undoubtedly these particular sins did exist among them, as a group they didn't tolerate them. And the result was that this was the reason why the Visigoths particularly and the Franks were able to defeat the Roman Empire. When the Visigoths defeated the Roman Emperor in 410 AD, nobody was more surprised than the Roman Emperor and Visigoths. And when the Visigoths defeated the Romans in 376 AD at Adrianople, the Visigoths couldn't believe it. They had been forced into Roman Italy, into the Roman Empire, because of the pressure of the Ostrogoths on their eastern flanks, and they were being pushed by the Huns.
And actually, they let them in deliberately.
Yes, they did. Well, the Visigoths asked to come in, and because the Roman patrones, the Roman free farmers, were diminishing, the land was not being occupied, so the Visigoths took up the land and began to farm it. The Visigoths were barbarians in the sense they weren't Roman. They were not barbarians in the sense of being destructive, just wantonly so. And they were terribly surprised as were the Romans at the Battle of Adrianople. Again, when they captured Rome, they were very much surprised they could do it, because and the Romans were horribly surprised. So that the moral vigor of the invading races was much stronger than was that of the decadent Roman people. And I would say that depending upon what date you select for the fall of the Roman Empire, some historians have selected 376 because it was the first time a Roman army had ever been defeated, an imperial army, since 360 B.C. That is on Roman soil. The Roman emperor had, Varro had suffered a serious defeat. General Varro had suffered a very serious defeat at Tewfik Forest in 9 A.D. But that was on Teutonic soil. It was not on Latin soil. I would say that the first signs of decay come in the 3rd century A.D. Some people have said it earlier. some might even set it with the coming of the empire. But I think when it first became Nineveh, and when you find it being mentioned in Latin literature, that Latin writers, Latin historians are becoming aware of the problem. The first one I remember seeing was about 235 A.D. Now, from there to 376 is what, 141 years? And from there to 410 A.D. is about 185 years. I would point out this, the motions in history are much more quick, are much more faster today than they were then. Rome didn't arise overnight. The Republic took a long time to emerge, and out of the Republic, the Empire finally emerged. But you see, Rome in the first century AD went through a series of revolutions. The Gracchi and Caesar and the others. So you have a series of upheaval.
The first thing isn't the moral decay. Just about civilization wide as far as European.
Yes, it is. The question is, don't jump on me, please. My feeling is that England is much closer than we are, in spite of the beauty of the English countryside and the grandeur of our past achievements, which I'm sure that Emily will agree with. The situation in England, we left was being very critical with the coal miners, a very ugly situation, and England is well down the tube. France is further.
Politically, morally what?
Morally, politically, every other way. Actually, not that she's without blame, not that it's what I would want of the nation. I suppose the one nation in Western Europe which has resisted this is West Germany. I suspect it's because the pressure of communist Russia on them that West Germany has maintained a healthier morality. I'm speaking in the broad sense of the word. The Netherlands is shot.
Would you also say, I felt like West Germany too, is because they really felt their family split when the town was split.
So yeah.
They felt that firsthand.
Very badly.
Very badly.
I've been in Germany, and I was impressed with the vigor and the morale of the German people, much more so than elsewhere in Europe. The Dutch are gone, the Sweden is gone, Denmark is gone, Norway is not as bad, England is going fast, Spain is gone, Italy's shot. There's a collective morale decline in morality. In Europe.
Well, the Soviet Union is pretty much the same thing as what we're trying now, isn't it?
Pardon me?
The Soviet Union, I mean, that, at least the European parts of it.
Yeah.
I have read, because other than that the alcoholism and drug problems are
alcoholism is rampant in Europe. Suicide is rampant in Sweden and Italy. It's interesting that Switzerland, Sweden, and Italy have the highest suicide rates in Europe. Why that is, people, sociologists ponder. The answer's right in front of them. But they would rather do their research than look at the evidence.
What do you mean? What is the answer?
It's in the growth of welfare state. Socialism produces suicide. It cuts the vital nerves of striving to achieve. And the welfare state in this country is killing this country. Now, the great question before us is this: can you stem the tide of decline, decay, and dissolution? It has never been done in history. Now, I grant you, that is from the pragmatic point of view to say that. There are a few places where a dissolution, first in Edmonds, has been stymied, or at least postponed, and that was the coming of the Roman Empire under Caesar Augustus after the century of revolution with the Gracchi and the others, which began about 111 B.C. and continued to 31 B.C. when Caesar Augustus put it to an end. That did not that that did not end the threat, but it did postpone. Rome was rapidly declining in the first century B.C. But the strong arm of Caesar Augustus and some able emperors, Trajan and Hadrian and so on, did postpone, no question about it. Again, you could say that Victoria, or should say Victorian England, brought a change from the terrible dissolution of the Hanoverian period of 18th century England, particularly the reigns of George I and George II, which were pretty bad, and the widespread dissolution in the English church, which was certainly brought to a stop each by the work of Whitfield and Wesley and their cohorts. There were other evangelists besides the Wesleys. The most noted of them, of course, was George Whitfield, the great Calvinist, and others. So, but there's no doubt that the revival of evangelical Christianity stayed the dissolution of England. it took a new turn under George IV and William III, and except at that time that England had a group of very, very able leaders. Lord Palmerston, Disraeli, Gladstone, Sir Robert Peel, Lord Salisbury, and others. And they with the backing of Victoria, set a high moral tone to 19th century England, as Emily was relating to us during the break. So there's a difference between a temporary stage of decline, which is a natural up and down in the history of any nation, and a prolonged, purposeful decline. 18th century England, if you read Lecky's History of Civilization in England in the 18th century, was a terrible time. However, even then, there were the strong forces for righteousness. I said the Wesleys and their other people, John Gill, Matthew Henry, and so on, and the great Scottish leaders. There was a break to it. Now, having said that, if you look at Western history as a whole, you'll see that the tempo of civilization has picked up tremendously. The rate of discoveries, I should say, scientific discoveries, the rate of their application. You know, I was thinking back, when I was in college, students didn't bring typewriters to class. They didn't have tape recorders to tape lectures. We didn't have television. What we didn't have today would make us seem poverty stricken. We weren't aware of that fact. We thought we had the good life. I can remember when I had a crystal set, and you'd pick up radio stations. I remember the thrill we had on a very clear night with no interference, on a crystal set, of picking up KDKA up in Pennsylvania. And that's one of the great historic stations. And one night, I got WSB in Atlanta. I nearly fell out of my chair. Imagine getting WSB in Atlanta.
We had the same problem.
Yeah, who wants to get today? I remember when he had a two-tube radio set, and I got WRBA Virginia, Richmond, Virginia. And all the girls were swooning over the. They had a disc jockey, but he was an announcer then, and he could really put on the honey. It dripped all over the radio. You take. I was thinking about them. You'll laugh. My cousin and I had a 1934 roaster, and one time we had the idea, we drove from Machuteck, Virginia to Fredericksburg, Virginia, lying on the back with the rumble seat enclosed, and we had ropes tied to our fingers and to a steering wheel. And we lay with our heads down and our feet dangling with that. We're this torch going up the highway from Machete to Petersburg, and we could see this car comes over, no driving. Of course, we could see where we were going. We had the accelerator fixed up, and the old force, it ran on the hand right underneath the steering wheel, so you could set it, and then have to keep your feet on it. And it would keep a fairly steady pace. And people get off the road while we went by. then we would go and we looked back, and you could see the look of awe. Well, today we get our license taken from us, but that's the way life went. And
what did you mean by prolonged purpose?
Well, I mean,
are we in a purpose?
Yes. Yes.
Purpose by
who? Well, by the degenerate who care nothing but the violent club. You talk to the average drug dealer, all he wants is money. You tap to the average drug user, and they can't do without their fix. I have tried talking to homosexuals, and they get very nasty. I must admit, I never talked to a lesbian, but I didn't want to be seen with one. I'm not happy about being seen with a homosexual, but I'm well enough known, I think, around town not to be confused with a homosexual. But I'm just downright scared of lesbians. I'm scared of homosexuals. But you talk to these people, they intend to go this way. There's a devilish intent. And it's inspired by a conspiracy. Now, I almost hesitate to tell you, but the candidate for the American Party, did anybody hear that on TV? You remember what he said?
What?
He said that Walter Mondale had been an agent of the KGB. Did you hear that?
Yeah. That's a rumor.
What? LaRue.
He's an independent Democrat.
No, this would be, or was it an independent Democrat?
Well, he called himself an independent Democrat, but
now, I've long suspected that connection, but I didn't have any evidence for him. No, I don't know if he does or not, but
when you go to the airport, they have representatives there. When you come up the escalator.
They do?
Yeah.
The American Party?
I've read that he was once a socialist.
Oh, he is a socialist. There's no question about that. Humphrey was a socialist. Humphrey was a socialist mayor of Milwaukee.
You don't think that was
true? In viewing what he says in the campaign, and viewing what, let's say, I don't think so.
Not
too extreme. No, I don't. I almost phrase that because I'm simply quoting LaRue.
I've read some of that stuff. There's a strange overlap in some of the things he says and some of the things you say, and yet some
polar opposite. Well, see, I don't know LaRue's, but let me say this, ladies and gentlemen. Theologically, I approach every question from the point of view of covenant theology as faithfully as I can. Politically, I approach everything from being an unreconstructed 1860 Democrat, following John T. Calhoun, Alexander H. Stevens, and the other saints of the cause.
Well, one of their views that I read from the papers is that they feel like, you know, that there is a conspiracy within this country which Henry Kissinger is the first part to assist the Russians in moving the world out.
Henry Kissinger, Nelson Rockefeller, and David Rockefeller, and people like that. Oh, the Harriman, Abel Harriman, who worked with Franklin Roosevelt to do this. Abel Harriman tangled with those who knew what was going on to bring on World War II. There's no question about this in my mind. If you read Anthony Sutton's work, you'll see this proved.
Well, you think Kissinger is in the sense that I think
he's
treasonous.
He's what?
Treasonous, I mean.
Well?
But, in the sense that he is promoting.
He did promote it the whole time he was Secretary of State.
You mean the Russian?
Oh, yes. He and the Rockefellers worked hand in hand.
At that very thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think, as distinct from the from temporary rises and falls, I may be disturbing you. If I am, I hope I am. I don't go for the extreme conspiracy theory. We know there was a conspiracy right before the war between the states in the 1850s. No question about it. Otto's book on that is very good. The six conspirators. There's no question about it. there's no question about just a conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln.
Why did they want to kill Abraham Lincoln?
Because, in brief, see, Lincoln, in his second address at inaugural, had said, with charity for all and malice toward none. Now, the men like Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, Ashley of Ohio, and the Secretary of War, Edmund Stanton, and others, had in mind absolutely crushing the South for their own end. Now, see, Lincoln's plan of Reconstruction was the famous 10% plan. Notably, when 10% of the voters of 1860 in any state would gain control of that state's government and rewrite the state constitution, they would be readmitted. And that original plan was killed by the Congress because they didn't like it. But when Andrew Johnson came in, he reinaugurated and put through the 10% plan in the Johnson Plan of Reconstruction. Now, see, the night that Lincoln died, Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, and a few others gathered in a hotel room in Washington, and Stevens said this: "Thank God that baboon is gone." Speaking of Mr. Lincoln. Well, the baboon was Stevens. He wasn't gone. Now, Stevens was a degenerate politician from Pennsylvania in league with the worst possible elements in Pennsylvania's politics, and that was pretty bad, who had taken up a shack, a Negro girl, and been run out of his town. What was the town? You all know. It was,
I wasn't there.
it was some town in southern Pennsylvania. I don't remember the name of it. Anyway, he was a degenerate character. He was an atheist. Charles Sumner was an atheist. And they wanted to use. I have a quote in here. Let me read from Thaddeus Stevens. This one's your question. Page 89. "In my youth, in my manhood, in my old age, I had fondly dreamed that when any future fortunate circumstances should have broken up for a while the foundations of our institutions, and he regarded the war as a fortunate situation, and released us from the foundation of the most tyrannical, speaking of the Constitution, that every man imposed the name of freedom, speaking of the Constitution, that the intelligent, pure, and just men like themselves of this republic, true to their professions and conscience, would have so remodeled all our institutions as to have freed us from every vestige of human oppression, of inequality of rights, of the recognized degradation of the poor and the superior caste of the rich." In other words, this is a communist note. Poor versus the rich. "In short, that no distinction should be tolerated in this purified republic but what arose from merit and conduct," namely their merit and their conduct. "This bright dream has vanished like the baseless fabric of our vision. I find that we shall have to be content with patching up the worst portions of this ancient edifice," meaning the Constitution, "and leaving it in many of its parts to be swept away by tempests, the frost, and the storms of despotism." End quote. Why did they do it? They wanted to have they wanted to have a complete devastation South in order to use the South as a model of what the whole nation must be. The restoration of the South, the reconstruction of the South, was to be followed by the reconstruction of the North. The whole fabric was to be remodeled, reconstructed. Not just the South. The South was a model. Now, our textbooks don't tell us that. But if you read Thaddeus Stevens, Charles Sumner, Ashley of Ohio, and others, you'll find this to be the case. There's no question about it. Now, in my constitutional studies, I took the opportunity to read the message of the Congress of Andrew Johnson, that much maligned statesman. Johnson was probably, along with John Quincy Adams and Pope and Grover Cleveland, one of the four most able men we had in the presidency. He was probably the most able student of the Constitution we've had in the presidency since John Quincy Adams. Andrew Johnson. Don't believe me. Get Richardson's messages and papers of the presidency and read his papers. Now, Johnson had accepted Lincoln's position of the restoration, not the reconstruction of the South, the restoration of the South on the 10% plan. And the textbooks, most of them, except McLaughlin's constitutional history, the modern textbook doesn't tell you a thing about this. He had reconstructed every southern state successfully on this model. And he thwarted Congress. And when Congress met in 1866, he presented Congress with a completed plan. And they were out to get it. Why? Because he had accepted Lincoln's plan. Now why? See, Lincoln's plan did not bring in democracy. It was based upon constitutional principles. The point in Lincoln was this. Since Lincoln denied the states had seceded, they were still states. Thus, you could not reconstitute them. You simply restored them. A big difference. A restored state would come in unimpaired. Johnson believed in that, accepted it. He not only believed and accepted it, he made it work. This angered Congress. And so they came within one vote of impeaching Johnson.
What was Congress's proposal? What was their proposal?
The 50% plan, which when 50% of people, a plan they knew couldn't get through. They couldn't get 50%. Now they could. As a matter of fact, Johnson did get 10% in every southern state. 50%? No, he wouldn't have done it. But Lincoln's theory had been that there had been a disloyal minority of, say, 10, 15, 20% that had brought about secession. Therefore, if you can get 10% to overturn secession, you can restore that state virtually unimpaired, unharmed, except for the actual physical damage of the war. That was his point. Now, what Thaddeus Stevens wanted was an untrammeled democracy. Have I made my point clear? I've never gone into this before in this institution, but since we're dealing with sort of thing. Now,
I'm not saying it's wrong.
Well, I'm perfectly willing to have you.
What I'm trying to frighten you is that if it can be said, that is not
I'm not making that legal charge.
I realize that, but what I mean is,
I'm saying that
on the other hand, you're not absolutely shocked by it.
No, I'm not a bit surprised about people who have long suspected it.
My question is, I happen to turn it on just purely by coincidence, but I think it's up. I was so shocked when I saw it, I haven't really seen anything about it since that point in time.
Well,
the newspapers surely didn't.
Do you think the major newspapers,
commercials, saying that same thing?
Who?
Well, I know
you won't say the journals.
The Atlanta Constitution is not like the Senate.
what I said is that it's allowed constitutional and no other mutiny seems to he came forth and blasted it and said this is the way it is, and I haven't seen the way anything.
Let me answer your question, John. I doubt that he would have said that if he did not have evidence, because that would be a case for libel and slander all told. But it was such a dangerous thing to say that the very danger of it is in favor of being true. Secondly, the more true it is, the less likely that the Constitution, the New York Times, the Atlanta Journal, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the Chicago Tribune, and the goodness knows about the Soldier, whatever it is, and the Los Angeles, whatever it is, and the Houston Chronicle will publish it.
The Atlanta Journal had a little place on the back page there in the last few nights saying that if he was suing NBC, and NBC had charged him with plotting the assassination of President
Trump. Who's suing? Why?
Isn't LaRue?
Who's suing? I didn't see it. We don't see them. And we get the Shaw Observer, that beautiful paper that covers the deal.
He was being charged with plotting to kill Carter back in 1977. It sounds kind of wild to me.
I would tend to doubt that. I don't know LaRue, but that's a little bizarre.
He's suing NBC.
Well,
yeah, he didn't say that. They said that.
I have the data on Westmoreland, and he's absolutely correct. And CBC was absolutely wrong. Now, a court such as may not, but I have all the data.
Mike Wallace was wrong?
The question that immediately comes to my mind, when have you been right?
There's a fellow by the name of Dr. Stuart Crane. Have you ever heard of him?
Stuart Crane, his brother.
Stuart Crane.
Is he the doctor?
He has a PhD in economics from Purdue University.
Yeah, he's Phil Crane's younger brother.
Phil Crane from Illinois?
Yeah.
I don't know. I didn't know about that.
Phil Crane is the Republican evangelical member of Congress in Illinois.
He tried to run for president
in
1980. Yeah. He's from Detroit. I don't know where he was from originally, but I don't think it's their brothers, really.
Maybe not.
But anyway,
he has a brother.
Anyway, Dr. Stuart Crane says that the reason Lincoln was assassinated is because he financed the war with greenbacks, with treasury notes.
That is true, but that wasn't why he was assassinated.
And the big money and the big bankers wanted a central bank where they could create money out of nothing and lend it to the government and collect interest on it.
Well, he always goes back in his financial history.
Huh?
He'll go back to his financial history. In 1862, they created and the national banks. The National Banking Act was passed in 1862, and that they'd already gotten because the national banks were given the right to have, let's say, $100,000 worth of capital, $1 million worth of capital. They could print national banking notes up to 10% of $900,000 or of $1 million, $910,000 or $100,000. In other words, they could print 90% of these notes, up to 90% of the total value of their capital. And if you look in his banking history, the bankers got exactly what they wanted and what the country needed.
You're saying that Lincoln didn't print greenbacks?
No, I'm saying he did, but he did exactly what the bankers wanted to do. See, the federal government had taken all the specie out of the bank vault in 1861, and they had brought about a crisis. So in 1862, in order to relieve that situation, they passed the first of three Greenback Acts, two in 1862 and one in 1863, by which, under these acts, $150 million worth were printed under each one of these acts. They got what they wanted. I mean, yeah. Stuart Craig don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, okay.
Now,
all right.
Back to my theme.
Yeah.
Question? I made the point that wherever democracy rears its head, it does so in alliance with political radicals. Now, before the war for independence, there had broken out in this country deism. It's described in the book, and I'm only going to touch on the high points. It broke radically with the biblical doctrine of the infallible scripture and its inspiration, with the biblical doctrine of creation, with the doctrines of man and sin and redemption, and adopted adopted what became known as deistic views. Now, deism was both a philosophy and a theology. In theology, it produced Unitarianism. In political philosophy, it produced the natural rights philosophy, which Jefferson used in the Declaration of Independence. Now, I was pointing out to you that this declaration exemplifies the errors. Namely this, that under the law of nature, man has the rights of life, liberty, and what? The pursuit of happiness. Now, no man has the right to pursue happiness. Man has the right to pursue the will of God. And he all Jefferson reversed the whole position. Man, why do you and I have rights? You and I have rights because we have duties. You and I have, we have a duty to have life, to protect our lives. We have a duty to have property because we are stewards of God. We have the duty of being free because we must use that freedom for the glory of God, both in our worship of God and in the use of our other gifts, whatever they may be. Now, under Jefferson's theory, which he derived from Locke, there's no possible way of having duties.
So the more responsibilities under Scripture that I take upon myself, the more freedom I have.
Correct. That man is most truly free who is most truly a slave of Jesus Christ, quotes St. Augustine. Order what thou wilt, O Lord, I shall do it, and I shall be free, quotes St. Augustine. George Matheson, make me a captive, Lord, and then I shall be free. Force me to render up my sword, and I shall conquer, babe, and that great hymn. Freedom finds its roots, its nourishment, its support, its guidelines, its submission to the will of God. It's not found in the blind operations of natural law, a la Thomas Jefferson. And Locke's victim of life, liberty, and property broke down because there were no safeguards. Locke's philosophy of all you learn through your senses has no room for duty. You can't smell duty, you can't taste duty, you can't hear duty, you can't feel duty. So, no way. Locke was horribly wrong. And Jefferson seized upon. Now, the pursuit of happiness, of course, is the great modern democratic idea. I have a right to be happy. If I leave my wife, that's my right. If my wife leaves me, that's her right. I have a right to be happy. I like to kill people. So you shoot an elk and kill 6 or 7 people. That gives you a certain amount of happiness. That's my right. Now, if you follow Jefferson, you have no logical way of combating that. If you follow a democratic philosophy, which means the majority is right, then the majority speaks with authority. And generally speaking, the majority is wrong. I used to tell my class at Catawba this. The French used to have a song that 50 million Frenchmen couldn't be wrong. But I point out in history they generally have been. Toynbee in his history makes the point that you always have to have a creative or dynamic minority to lead. and James Park showed me today a copy of my book on Toynbee translated into Korean language. How many copies did they print? You know? But they use the schools over there, don't they?
Did you proofread it?
Huh?
Did you proofread it?
Yeah. Yeah, I proofread. My Korean got rusty, but I could do it then. Now, you see, the majority of Amos, John Adams saw it very clearly. He said, the mob is a beast. Wasn't very complimentary, but you get his point. Now, deism then spearheaded the intellectual revolt which preceded the American War for Independence. Now, I point to you, it was not the only cause, but it was a cause. If you read Franklin Jameson's book, if you read Mosier's book, The American Temper, if you read the other texts, the other books written on this subject, you'll find that this is the case. A very good book is Carl Becker's book, The Heavenly City, the 18th Century Philosophers. All point this point. There's a very good book, I think it's just recently been reprinted, but it was written by Moses Coit Tyler. It's called A Literary History of the American Revolution, in which he brings it out very clearly. Now, I am not saying for a moment that deism made its way down into the average church and swept the mind of people. Didn't. It was popular in eastern Massachusetts, in and around Boston. It gained a foothold in Harvard. It gained a foothold at Yale. It gained a foothold among men like Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, Ethan Allen, Richard Henry Lee. It seeped into part of northern Virginia, well, eastern Virginia, because of the British officials who killed Lord Fauquier and the other Lord Viterture, who were the royal governors in colonial Virginia. They were deists. They came up from England, and the result was that they taught it to the groups that met for coffee at the Raleigh Tavern in Williamsburg, and it seeped into Virginia society. On the other hand, it met with great opposition in Virginia society. It affected Willie Jones and a few others, friends of Jefferson, who were from North Carolina. But the bulk of North Carolinians could care less about deism. The South Carolinians cared a great deal. They opposed it. And if they thought a man was a deist, they promptly let him know that he was an atheist as far as they were concerned. But it was strong in around Pennsylvania and around the Philadelphia area and in some parts of New Jersey, but very strong in Yale and Harvard and among some of the elite in around New York. But the leadership of the Philadelphia Congress of 1776 guided the writing of this document, particularly Franklin and Jefferson. Franklin was a deist, and at that time a pretty ardent anti-Christian. Jefferson was violent anti-Christian. And when you see presidential candidates, notably Mondale and Carter, generally speaking, Democratic candidates, Roosevelt, and they always quoted Jefferson. Politicians always quote Jefferson. I grant a lot of them don't know what he thought, but it sounds good. No, I haven't any idea what Jefferson really said. There's a book written by T.P. Martin, The Life of Jefferson Told by Himself. It's published by the University of Virginia Press about 1943 or 4, I forget which date. Which is a remarkable book. It's a collection of Jefferson's statements and letters and documents on raised, say, on agriculture, on foreign affairs and whatnot. It arranged in epics. A young man of William and Mary in the Continental Congress in France as Secretary of State, as President Jones. And they have about five or six major topics, and they deal with the under each one of those major topics, they did chronologically with what he wrote on those topics. It reveals the mind of Jefferson in an amazing way. And what comes out is not a very pretty picture. And if you doubt what I'm saying, you can get these books. And you'll see what was really in the wind. Now, I am not trying to say that the war for independence was won because of theists. There were other causes at work. There were constitutional issues. But I would say this, they could have been resolved. As a matter of fact, in 1779, Lord North was so anxious to solve this problem that he sent a deputation over to General Washington. It was known as the Carlisle Mission. And did you know this? Well, it was. And Lord North yielded to every demand the Continental Congress except independence. Now, the reason for it was very interesting. Franklin had been able to sign two treaties with France, one for military aid, the other for commercial help and finances. And England knew about them. And so they figured that since they're getting ready to go to war with France, that might be a good thing to settle with colonies. But by 1779, of course, Valley Forge was over, Burgoyne had surrendered in 1778, and so the feeling of victory was in the air, and so the Continental Congress refused it. But England did make overtures. Now why? If you read Jefferson, you'll find out why. He wanted independence from Great Britain, to have a totally new start, to have democracy in the air. The whole Declaration of Independence breathes the spirit of democracy. Now, as a legal paper, it has no standing. Why? Because the indictments named the wrong party. If the prosecuting attorney in a case finds a murder, and he can't find the real murderer, so he indicts another person, that's a false indictment. And when the case comes to court, the judge says, "Listen, bud, you better get your thing in order because this fellow's guilty," and he dismisses the case. Jefferson indicted the King of England. Now, the King of England had not done it. Parliament had done these things. Now, some of these were not indictable offenses. Some of these were good things, but they hit some of the colonies as a false bill of indictment. Therefore, the conclusion that these colonies ought to be free and independent states, legally speaking, logically, is wrong. You say, boy, am I a traitor? Am I? No, I'm not. But as a historian, I have to be fair. I have to be absolutely true to the fact. However, let me point this out. Are you getting upset, Bill?
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad somebody is. However,
Can we revolt now?
No. Out of that came great good. The Lord used evil men. He used evil things. He used mistakes, and now he's brought great glory. So I gladly affirm my allegiance to the United States of America. But that does not change the historical facts of the case. It does not change the fact that deism was the guiding philosophy of the leaders of the movement. It does not disguise the fact that with Jefferson and Franklin, Patrick Henry, and Richard Henry Lee and others, that the philosophy of democracy gained a foothold and a popularity in this country. There's no question about that. And therein was the seed of dissolution sown. Now, it didn't take effect because after the war, there was a great resurgence of what we call constitutional orthodoxy. The Articles of Confederation had failed, the country was in chaos by 1786, and the Philadelphia Convention. Now, to prove what I'm saying, the Philadelphia Convention contained 56 people. Only six of them had been members of the Congress of 1776. Of those six, four were noted conservatives. John Dickinson, who refused to sign the Declaration of Independence. George Read, also from Delaware. Followed by the name of John Rutledge from South Carolina. All conservatives. There were, at best,
possibly three or four, five, six real radicals in the Philadelphia Convention. Lansing and Yates from New York were, but they were overshadowed by Mr. Hallam, who was an evangelical Christian. Now, when the Philadelphia Convention met, I'm not for a moment saying they were all, quote, reborn Christians. I am saying, however, that the delegates from Massachusetts, for the most part, were evangelical. Two of the three delegates from Massachusetts, from Connecticut, Oliver Ellsworth and Roger Sherman, were outstanding evangelicals. Rhode Island sent a real radical, probably an atheist. No, he wasn't. He was a strict deist, though. Alexander Hamilton came from New York. A fellow by the name of James Wilson, one of the three or four great lawyers of the day, and a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian, was from Pennsylvania. Franklin, by this time on the way to conversion, was from Pennsylvania. Delaware sent John Dickinson, one of the most noted evangelicals and Calvinists of his day. New Jersey had sent Elias Boudinot. Not too long ago, the Christian Today had a long feature article on Elias Boudinot from New Jersey, a French Huguenot. And I could go on and on and on. North Carolina sent James Idle, who later became a member of the first Supreme Court, and he was Chief Justice of the state of North Carolina, a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian from the neighboring, well, from Idle County today. And so on. I mentioned just a few in passing. John Rutledge, a strict Calvinistic evangelical, the Episcopalian from South Carolina. So on. These men and others were under the impact. They had, there was a common consensus as to the biblical and particularly the Calvinistic frame of government. So the whole philosophy of democracy received a very serious setback. But Jefferson, who had been in France when the convention was meeting, was called back by Washington to be Secretary of State, largely because he had great deal of foreign affairs experience. Franklin died in 1790, was not available. And John Jay became the first Chief Justice Supreme Court of the United States. Now, John Jay was probably one of the leading evangelical Calvinists of the day. He with his son, William Jay, and Mr. William Smith, the Secretary of Navy in the Madison administration, founded the American Bible Society. As you read the Jay papers, did you know this? The Jay papers are available. And if you read these Jay papers, they are gems. I've just been reading them. They are gems for his concept of missionary activity. He was a real layman evangelist. He was an ardent Christian, and he spoke with great force on the force of scriptures in American society and over the world. The textbooks never tell you that. They give him maybe four or five sentences. Well, he got the Jay Treaty, and he was first Chief Justice, and that's it. But he was one of the top diplomats of the day. Unbelievably good. He got the Jay Treaty, which was a real achievement.